From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet comic Jon Stewart, the host of Comedy Central's nightly news satire, The Daily Show. This summer, the show will broadcast from the Democratic and Republican conventions. Also, a rock critic who was larger than life than many of the people he wrote about. We talk with Jim DeRogatis about the late Lester Bangs, who wrote for Rolling Stone, The Village Voice, and Cream in the 60s and 70s. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz tells us about a new production of Macbeth that's about to open on Broadway, starring Kelsey Grammer. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Federal Communications Commission has announced a plan designed to cut consumer phone bills. NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
The agreement will drop the charges paid by long-distance providers to local phone companies by over $3 billion this year alone. Local companies can make up some of that money by raising what's known as the subscriber line charge on consumers' phone bills. But it's hoped the cut in rates will unleash a price war among long-distance companies that will drop rates overall. Consumers will see one change right away. AT&T and Sprint have promised to offer at least one plan without a minimum monthly fee. Consumer groups say those minimums have hurt callers who make few long-distance calls. The agreement is a compromise engineered by the FCC and a coalition of long-distance and local phone companies. MCI WorldCom and US West refused to sign on, saying the deal had no guaranteed benefits for consumers. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
Lawyers for Microsoft Corporation have attacked the Justice Department's proposal for splitting the giant software company in two. Microsoft said the government plan was vague and ambiguous and therefore impossible to enforce. Microsoft's lawyers also said top executives from Compaq Computer Company and DreamWorks, the movie production house, would testify that a Microsoft breakup would harm their industries. The judge has already ruled that Microsoft violated antitrust law and is expected to rule shortly on a remedy. The Transportation Department has begun a series of hearings on its proposals for limiting the amount of time truckers and bus drivers can spend behind the wheel each day. NPR's Carol Ann Clark-Kelly reports.
Under the proposed rules, long-distance bus drivers and truckers would not be allowed to work more than 12 hours a day, and long-haul truckers would be required to install black boxes to monitor their compliance. David Oshecki with the American Truckers Association says the proposals would make highways less safe.
A driver will know that the clock is ticking once his or her shift begins. This regulatory approach will promote aggressive driving and unsafe driving behavior.
But auto safety advocate Jackie Gillen thinks these arguments are scare tactics.
We would all be better off and would really do something serious about the problem of truck safety if we had better rested truck drivers out on the road.
The Transportation Department says the changes could prevent more than 2,000 accidents a year and save up to 115 lives. Carol Ann Clark-Kelly, NPR News, Washington.
President Clinton said today that if the U.S. develops a missile defense system, it would be unethical not to share it with what he called civilized nations. The president will visit Moscow later this week for a summit meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin, who strongly opposes a U.S. missile defense. In stocks, the Dow Industrials lost 5 points to close at 10,522 in moderate trading of 943 million shares. This is NPR News. Firefighters in Arizona's Kaibab National Forest say they have a wildfire about 40% contained, but they predict a long fight ahead. High winds and dry conditions have spread the fire over 9,500 acres. Forest officials say the fire may not be fully contained until rains come during the summer monsoon season. A gunman with a history of mental illness is holding 29 children and 3 adults hostage at a daycare center in Luxembourg. Janine Johnson-Meyer reports.
Police say the hostage taker is about 40 years old and is a Luxembourger of Tunisian origin. He has 2 children, one of whom once attended the daycare center in the village of Wasserbillig, where he is holed up with the hostages. He is believed to be armed with a pistol, 2 hand grenades, a knife, and a container of gasoline. His motive is still unclear, but he has asked for a car and a 15-seat plane. Unconfirmed reports say he wants the plane to take him to Libya. Police are negotiating with the man through his psychiatrist. 8 children freed earlier in the day have been reunited with their parents. The children remaining in the center are between 4 and 7 years of age. Such incidents are virtually non-existent in Luxembourg. The wealthy country has strict gun control laws, and except in rare instances, it is illegal to possess hand grenades. For NPR News, this is Janine Johnson-Maya in Brussels.
U.S. warplanes bombed northern Iraq today for the third day in a row. The U.S. European Command said American jets bombed air defense systems about 250 miles north of Baghdad after the sites opened fire on them. The statement said the U.S. planes returned safely to their bases in southern Turkey. Iraq says the zones are violations of its territorial sovereignty. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, comic Jon Stewart, anchors Comedy Central's nightly news satire, The Daily Show. Here's Stewart on last night's edition, talking about the recent NRA convention.
NRA members also pulled the trigger on an unprecedented third term for acting president Charlton Heston.
I want to say those fighting words for everyone within the sound of my voice to hear and to heed, and especially for you, Mr. Gore. From my cold, dead hands.
Okay, cut. Chucky. It's a convention, baby. It's not the Omega Man. You gotta tone it down.
From my cold, dead hands.
It's all wrong. You're scaring the kids.
Jon Stewart took over The Daily Show in January of 1999. Stewart previously played himself on The Larry Sanders Show, Gary Shandling's spoof of late-night talk shows. Stewart also hosted his own interview show on MTV. On June 8th, he'll make his Carnegie Hall debut at the Toyota Comedy Festival. This summer, Stewart will anchor The Daily Show from the Republican and Democratic political conventions. I asked Jon Stewart what he finds silliest or most self-important about TV news shows.
The new shows basically function as entertainment shows. So our show can live in that area between what news shows ostensibly are supposed to be and what news shows are, which is just another vehicle for ratings for a network. So we live in sort of that area of you won't believe what's growing in your washing machine. What you don't know about it could kill your children. That sort of scare tactic. When they use their tactics of scaring and sensationalizing things just to get people to tune in. And that's I think the pompousness that we exploit.
So what are some of the stories you've done using the same kind of scare techniques as the news magazines?
Well, we did a big story on gravity and how it could be affecting your children, keeping them on the ground, etc., and what a dangerous thing it might be. It was just a huge promo with kids on a slide. You know, we used all the, you know, that empty swing on the playground.
Oh, right.
That they use every now and again to show that if you don't watch this thing, your child could be gone from the swing. I'm not really sure what it means. So it was about gravity. We did another one on Ritalin. And the basic premise of the Ritalin one was our correspondent, Steve Carell, listed all the symptoms where you could tell if your child had ADHD. And they were things like wants his mommy, keeps outgrowing clothes, which was basically every child in the country. And so his premise was everyone, all kids should be on Ritalin because it makes it a lot easier for parents. And while he was discussing all the various options, he was taking the pills himself, and he ended up tripping.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Now, you're going to be at the Democrat and Republican conventions, I believe.
Yes.
Have you been to a convention before?
I have been to a convention before. It was the Shriners, and they were wonderful. They were very open, not very much politicking. I did go, I think when the Democratic convention was in New York, I went to it one day when it was up at Madison Square Garden. And wow, is that boring. Talk about boring. Talk about a waste of time. There used to be, you know, remember the old days when, like, people would riot and stuff and they'd throw Dan Rather off the floor, you know, that kind of thing? Yeah, they don't do that anymore. Now it's just, again, it's sort of the entertainment value of it. It's produced like the Emmys in 1982. you know, you almost expect, you know, the first lady to come out in a Bob Mackie. And, you know, they'll cut together some really cheesy montage about how they're trying to help people. And then every now and again, cut away to whoever it is has the characteristic that they're trying to help. You know, I remember when the Republicans were in their big tent phase. I don't know if you remember that.
Mm-hmm.
They used to talk about, hey, we're Republicans. We're inclusive now. And the nice thing about politics is you don't actually have to be the things you say you are because there's no truth in advertising there. So they basically go, well, we're inclusive. For instance, black people, we're very fond of them. And then they would cut away towards, like, there'd be a black guy in the audience, you know, and they'd cut away to him. But unfortunately, you know, they wanted to talk a lot about how they were fond of black people, but they only had, like, one black guy in there, so they just kept cutting away to the same guy. And after a while, I just felt like, geez, change your hat, dude. You know, at least make an effort to show that there's someone else there.
So what's your plan at the conventions? Where are you going to be? What do you hope to, who do you hope to talk to? What do you hope to do?
Well, we're going to have, you know, we're putting together our list of analysts right now. We've got Senator Dole is lined up to be an analyst. I think former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich will be there working with us. We're hoping to get a lead on maybe Senator Bob Kerry. You know, we discussed when we were in Philadelphia, we actually had Arlen Specter on the show a while back. So we're hoping Arlen will do some work with us again. So those are the people that we're putting together. The main thing is we're going to be doing our show with our correspondents out on the floor, covering this thing in the best way we know how. We're already putting together our Man from Hope films about the candidates and and those kinds of things. We're probably going to be doing the evocative cutaway of the night, which will be, you know, if they're talking about child care and they cut away to a baby in the audience, for instance, that will probably be our cutaway of the night.
If you try to, say, get an interview with one of the politicians at a convention, yes. Do you think a lot of them will, like, run the other way? Do you think a lot
no.
of politicians are afraid of being on a comedy show, that they're not going to be funny enough or that they'll be mocked?
There's a sense of that, but I think there's a more overwhelming sense of, is that a media outlet? Does that beam my image out to people's homes? Let me at it.
I think they've all hired writers. I think they've all hired, like, comic writers to zets up their jokes and write them jokes.
Right, but what, you know, that's not so annoying as the fact that they've all hired writers to zets up their policies. You know, that's,
right.
I mean, that's the whole thing that's interesting to me is that comedy is sort of looked upon as a point of interest in political campaigns, and people talk about, geez, you know, when do you draw the line at a joke, and how do you go too far, and isn't it annoying that politicians are trying to be funny? And I don't find any of that annoying because it's all under the guise of entertainment. What I find annoying is that they use the exact same principles to do that as they do to form policy. And that's I think, where we're in a little bit of trouble. It's not so much that, you know, Gore hired a guy to write him a couple of jokes, depending on what crowd he was working to. It's that he hired somebody to make sure that his shirt tones made him look manly and that his policies wouldn't offend the certain demographic that he thinks is a core element of the, you know, it's all smoke and mirrors.
Jon Stewart, I first heard about you when you signed for the MTV show, The Jon Stewart Show.
First of all, thank you for calling me Jon Stewart. I think that's very nice to use my whole name. Terry Gross.
Oh, yes. All right. Okay.
You know what's nice about this, Terry?
What's nice about this?
You don't find me amusing in the slightest.
No, I do. No, why do you think? See, wait. I'm going to stop you right here. First of all, let me explain something to our listeners. We are talking long distance. I'm in a studio in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And John's in a studio.
And I'm naked on an air mattress somewhere in Hoboken.
That's right. So, now you can't see me smiling with amusement.
I can't?
No, and unless I laugh out loud, you think you're really you're not.
I have a picture of you sitting here smiling and nodding. It's on a bobble-headed doll.
See, but I'm just faking it in the smile.
Every time
these
I
smiles
make a joke,
are. I'm faking it in the photo, but these smiles are for real here.
All right, that's very nice, Terry.
Oh, I think it's really hard for a comic like you to be alone in a studio with nobody in there as an audience,
not even your interviewee.
It's
hard for a comic like me
mm-hmm.
to be alone anywhere. I'm a needy son of a bitch. No, I'm sorry. All right.
Well,
there you go. No fake laughter, Terry. I won't have that.
See, now that's the thing. Now I have to just fake laughter to make you feel more secure.
No,
is that fair?
Don't. Not at all. Here's the thing. I feel tremendously secure by the fact that NPR has asked me to come on it. You have no idea the kind of validation that means to me.
So now we could both be very disingenuous and proceed.
Yes, I am. That my career is to be disingenuous. That's my whole career. If I wasn't disingenuous, I'd actually be helping people charity-wise. Think of all the crazy things I think about the government, and if I was actually a genuine person, I'd be out there doing something about it.
Oh, right.
Instead of writing a bunch of jokes.
Well, now let me say that I first heard about you in, I guess it was it 94 that you got the MTV show, the Jon Stewart show?
Yes.
And you were being pitched as like the next hot young guy. And then less than a year later, you lost the show and you became the guy who got canceled. And I always wonder what it was like for you to, in a pretty rapid span of time, go from like the hot guy to the canceled guy.
Hot guy to canceled guy. Well, the truth is you're not really that much different. Like when I was the hot guy, I wasn't any taller or better looking. And when I was the canceled guy, I wasn't any shorter or uglier. Do you know what I mean? You're still the same. That was a lesson I learned early on, is that as long as you have the ability to do what you do, which is write jokes, it really doesn't matter what they're calling you, because they don't live with you. Unless people in your apartment are actually saying that. That would be harder. Like if you woke up and they went, "Hey, you're the canceled guy. Hey, come on, I'm just trying to get some eggs. What's that canceled guy?" You don't really hear that a whole lot. I mean, you read about it, but it's not like you physically feel when you're hot and when you're not. And in other words, it's not like I went out much more anyway when I was hot or something, when I was on MTV. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but
they weren't like holding parades for me in the street, and every time I'd walk by, they'd go, "It's the hot guy. Hey, everybody, it's the hot guy." And then I would, when I was canceled, they're like, "We will shun you," like West Point. Everybody just turned their back, and they were silent.
But don't you get more offers and more money when you're the hot guy than when you're the canceled guy?
I don't know. I mean, the big difference is I didn't have an office to go to every day.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't like I didn't stop working.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess maybe the money was less. I mean, it wasn't so dramatic, I guess. It wasn't like I went from an Oscar winner to a crack addict.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, when I was the hot guy, I wasn't exactly that hot. I was, you know, my cable show looked like it was doing well. And when I was the canceled guy, it's not like, it was Seinfeld, and I got dropped out. You know what I mean?
Yeah, right.
It was a pretty small-time deal to begin with.
Right,
so
got it.
I guess the disparity wasn't that great.
Yeah.
And also, in my barometer is more internal than external to begin with.
My guest is Jon Stewart, the anchor of Comedy Central's nightly news satire, The Daily Show. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Jon Stewart is my guest, and he's the host of The Daily Show with Jon Stewart on Comedy Central. And the show will be going to the political conventions this summer, and Jon Stewart will be headlining at the Toyota Comedy Festival in New York. How did you decide to, like, try stand-up? What made you think that you would feel comfortable standing in front of an audience doing your 4 minutes or 7 minutes or whatever, you know, when you were just getting started?
I guess my work at Alcoholics Anonymous. I guess the fact that, you know, I'd done so well in that room.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's a rhythm. It really is a rhythm that either makes sense to you or doesn't. It's mm-hmm. I think it's similar to, you know, I would watch somebody who's a musician and just go, "Wow, that looks like magic to me." But I'd watch a comedian and go, "Huh, that's, yeah, all right. I could see why he thinks that." So it's a rhythm that makes sense to you. That is your thought process is that, you know, to get up on stage for the first time, obviously you're doing more of an impression of a comedian than you are yourself. You're writing jokes that you think are supposedly funny and that sort of thing. And then it takes a long time to sort of discover your own rhythm. But the rhythm itself made sense to me.
Did you do autobiographical stuff in your early stage?
Everybody does. The basic sort of, here's the sort of evolution of man as comedian.
Yeah.
It's sort of like that little chart. You start out talking about your family. That'll get you about 20 minutes. 20 minutes of material. That 20 minutes of material gets you on the road. When you get on the road, you develop your 15 to 20 minutes of, hey, you guys ever been to Chattanooga? Hey, that's a crazy town. You know, they got a museum there of old cars joke. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So you get your I'm a comedian on the road. Hey, hotels, come on, people, that's soap. Seriously, people, anyone? And then also you're spending a lot of time in rooms watching TV, so that's mm-hmm. when you first develop your, have you seen this commercial about the guy in the Kotex? So there's that bit. And so you develop your thing, and then at a certain point you exhaust all of that, and you turn to the events of the day. And that's, I think, sort of the general evolution of the comedian. So you don't, you know, and some people stay with the family thing all the time. They can mine that. But the majority of people move off of that once they've mined it. Because the problem is once you start being a comedian, you stop living to a certain extent.
Or because you're on the road all the time?
Well, you stop living a sort of a normal life. It's like with the rock bands, you know, everybody always writes their heroin song or their Geez, It's Lonely on the Road song, you know, mm-hmm. on a steel horse I ride, because I'm a wanted, wanted, dead or alive. And I think we all know Bon Jovi's not actually wanted, dead or alive. I think we understand he's not an outlaw, but he is on a steel horse, a bus, a metaphor for the loneliness of the road. And so that's what we all do.
Now, you grew up in a neighborhood in New Jersey that you've said had very few Jewish families in it. And you were one of the few. There's, I think it's in Annie Hall where Woody Allen imagines what Diane Keaton is going to think of him when she takes him to meet her very non-Jewish parents.
Yeah, very funny scene.
Yeah, and he imagines himself with looking like an ultra-Orthodox Jew with payas and the beard and everything. Did you have a self-image about how you thought people in your neighborhood saw you as the Jewish guy in the neighborhood, the Jewish kid?
It was wrapped up in not just that. It wasn't pure, you know, we weren't Orthodox by any stretch of the imagination. But it was more just, I didn't have a vision of what I thought they saw me as. I saw what they saw me as. I was an ugly, ugly small boy. My head is the same size as it was now. My body was about a quarter of the size it is now. So I literally looked like a Jewish Peanuts character. I looked like Shlomo, the Peanuts character next to Franklin. So it was a giant head. And just as the body started to grow, my head decided to cover itself with acne. So sort of a no-win situation. But yeah, no, it wasn't. You got to understand, humor is about deflecting criticism in many ways. But that's not the only. It's a rhythm that I was comfortable with mm-hmm. from the start.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't come up with jokes because I thought, oh, if I make a joke, girls will like me. It wasn't cognitive. It was a rhythm that I understood somehow from the start, just as a very young kid.
Okay, now you didn't think that if I come up with jokes, girls will like me, but nevertheless, was it easier to attract girls when they realized that you were funny? Was that a help at all? You know, a lot of musicians say that they started playing music right. because it was easier to meet women that way.
Let me make something very clear here.
Yeah.
The worst bass player in the world gets laid more than the best comedian. So if this was an attempt to score women, here's what it did. Hey, John, go talk to those girls and loosen them up a little bit so that your good-looking friends can come in and get laid. Here's the thing. The first time I got to second base with a girl, I was in my car. I had a gremlin, okay? I was 17 years old. First time I got to second base, and it wasn't me doing it. It was a friend of mine with a girl in the back seat, and I was watching through the rearview mirror, but I counted it. You see what I'm saying? I counted it. I'm not proud of that.
My guest is Jon Stewart. He hosts The Daily Show on Comedy Central. And the show will be going to the Democratic and Republican conventions this summer, the presidential conventions. Is there anything you're really looking forward to and anything you're particularly dreading about doing the show from the conventions in the summer, from the political conventions?
Well, from a technical aspect, anytime you move the show into a place where you're not accustomed to doing it, there's going to be a lot of glitches, and we're going to have to overcome those. But the beauty of it is everybody's in it for the long haul. I mean, we're in it, and the excitement of being there and the excitement of feeling relevant, because we're not actually a news show. We're a fake news show.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not really relevant. We don't ever break news. We react to it. You know, if we broke news about something, it wouldn't be funny. If we made jokes about Monica Lewinsky before anybody knew who she was, that probably wouldn't have gone over so big. So we're really just a reactive comedy show, but we'll feel relevant because we'll be in the environment of the conventions, and that will feel exciting.
Is it at the point yet where there's, like, a lot of comics at the convention? Like, is Bill Maher bringing his show there, and you guys are bringing your show there? And do you fear at some point it will be like there's too many comics at the convention?
I really don't think the public would put up with that. I really don't. I think they are barely putting up with the fact that there's too many networks at the convention.
Oh, right.
They're not even watching it. I mean, most networks are scaling back their coverage anyway. They're not going gavel to gavel.
That's right.
You know why?
Why?
Nothing happens.
Well, but you have to hope that something does happen, don't you?
No. That's the beauty of it.
Oh, the kind of trite it is. Yeah.
Exactly. All we have to hope is that they make it seem like something's happening.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Okay.
That's the area we live. That's our house.
Well, good luck at the convention.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Have a good time there.
And I appreciate that.
Tell us a little bit about what you're doing at the Comedy Festival. What's your stand-up act like now? I think most of us know you more from television and from your show.
I will be performing at Carnegie Hall on June 8th, and I will be talking about everything from the hoax that is the computer age to Ilian Gonzalez to my dog throwing up. It's that wide-ranging.
Okay.
Does that make any sense? I've made no sense with you. I feel an immense pressure to be on NPR and to make sense. Because I don't want to get that. You know, I was on NPR once before, and we read a story from my book, and it got, you know, you get those calls the next day. I'm a professor of history in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and I take exception to Mr. Stewart's qualification of artistic merit as he said, poopy. Now I disagree with him. You indeed. And I'm returning my tote bag. Toot sweet! There, see? Terry Gross laughs at the NPR jokes, and that's it.
Jon Stewart anchors Comedy Central's nightly news satire, The Daily Show. On June 8th, he'll make his Carnegie Hall debut as part of the Toyota Comedy Festival. By the way, I think that professor has called us, too. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Saab, introducing the new performance lineup, the 9.5 Arrow and the 9.3 Viggen. Information available at saabusa.com and 1-800-SAAB-USA. And from Random House, Inc.'s Delta Trade Paperbacks Division, publisher of Protecting the Gift, A Parent's Guide to Keeping Children and Teenagers Safe by Gavin DeBecker. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the bad boy of rock criticism, we talk with Jim DeRogatis about his new biography of the late Lester Bangs. We're listening to a recording by Count Five, a group Bangs champion. And Lord Schwartz reviews a new production of Macbeth, starring Kelsey Grammer.
I feel depressed, I feel so bad. Cause you're the best girl that I've ever had. I can't get your love, I can't get affection. Oh, we'll be right back.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The late rock critic Lester Bangs is the subject of the new biography, Let It Blurt, that also tells the early history of rock criticism. My guest is the author, Jim DeRogatis, the pop music critic for the Chicago Sun-Times. He describes Bangs as having reveled in the excesses of rock and roll, matching its passion in prose that erupted from the pages of Rolling Stone, Cream, and The Village Voice. In the process, he became a peer of the artists he celebrated, brash visionaries and dedicated individualists such as Iggy Pop, Patti Smith, Richard Hell, and Lou Reed. Although Bangs was known for his excesses, DeRogatis says that this is not just the story of a guy who drank Romalar cough syrup by the gallon, insulted rock stars, then died. Without the poetry of his writing and his singular lust for life, the story would not have been worth telling. Bangs started publishing in the late 60s. He died in 1982 at the age of 33 of what is believed to have been a drug overdose. I asked DeRogatis to sum up Bangs' importance.
He was sort of the Jack Kerouac and the Charles Bukowski and the Hunter S. Thompson of rock criticism all rolled into one, a character who in many regards was larger than any of the people he wrote about, or at least as large, as much of a rock star as many of the rock stars he wrote about.
Can you read a paragraph from one of Lester Bangs' pieces that will help show why you think he was so special?
Absolutely. This is from the piece Psychotic Reactions and Carburetor Dung, which gives his anthology its name, 1987 anthology that Grill Marcus edited. Perhaps the truest autobiography I could ever write, and I know this holds as well for many other people, would take place largely at record counters, jukeboxes, pushing forward in the driver's seat while AM walloped you on, alone under headphones with vast scenic bridges and angelic choirs in the brain through insomniac post-midnights, or just to sit at leisure, stoned or not, in the vast benign lap of America, slapping on sides and feeling good.
And what do you like about that?
That's Lester on being a fan, on loving music, on being driven to preach about the music he loved.
Yeah, he once described shopping for records as being a major form of self-expression for him when he was young.
Yeah, and in another passage, described it as therapy, as something that saved his sanity. You know, he grew up in this what he called this ice cream and television suburban world of El Cajon, California, a suburb of San Diego, and he grew up a Jehovah's Witness. His mom was a fanatic religious person. There are pictures of him marching in front of San Diego Kingdom Hall with a sign that says, "What is your destiny?" And, you know, he had to go door to door and proselytize, and music was forbidden in the home. And it's never still to this day, not a big part of Jehovah's Witnesses services. So when he broke out via the manic jazz of Mingus and Coltrane and beat poetry, he went in a big way. And then rock and roll was even more of a salvation. It was his way out of this entire upbringing.
You met Lester Bangs when you were a senior in high school. You were given the assignment of interviewing a hero. So you chose Bangs, you went to his apartment in Manhattan and did an interview with him, and in fact you've brought some excerpts of that interview with you now. What were you expecting him to be like?
I think I had the cliched notion that a lot of his readers had, that he was this manic guy bouncing off the walls, some unholy combination of Hunter Thompson and Charles Bukowski and every rock star I'd ever seen, you know, Johnny Rotten and Jack Kerouac at the same time. And, you know, he wasn't like that at all. He was like my buddy. He was very solicitous of my opinions. He wanted to know what I was thinking, what I was reading, you know, what I was excited about. And I was that kind of blew me away. I wasn't prepared for that. You know, I was like, I'm a 17-year-old putz from New Jersey. What do you mean? You're Lester Bangs. But he was like that with everyone. He was very, very he always sought to communicate and find out what was getting people excited. And I think to him, rock and roll criticism was at its best when it was a discourse between people who were passionate about the subject, as passionate as he was.
You were talking to him a bit in your interview about his bad boy image and his image of, like, insulting people all the time, and this was his response.
You know, I mean, there was a time in my life when you would have come up here today and I would have got all drunk and everything and really, you know, just you might have preferred it that way and been really exhibitionistic, you know, and all that. But if I act like that, I ain't gonna, I mean, I might live a long time, but I won't live very long as a good writer, you know. It's just... that's just the way it goes, the way it works. You know, like, you know, Charles Bukowski. Well, I mean, he's reached a point now. He's this poet out in L.A., you know? And he gets his picture taken all the time wearing a T-shirt with his face on it that says Bukowski on it. And he writes, he wrote a poem behind his latest book that says, I can't write, you know? That's what he's used to, is writing a poem about how he can't write.
That was Lester Bangs, recorded in a 1982 interview with my guest, Jim DeRogatis. And now DeRogatis has written a new biography of the late Lester Bangs. Jim, it's really ironic that Bangs was talking about how, you know, he thought he'd live longer if he by not being that combative personality in real life. He actually died just a couple of weeks after this interview that he recorded with you. What did he die of?
It was 2 weeks later when the news broke of his death, and I think for a very long time it's lingered out there, and nobody in the rock world was really certain. It's sort of obfuscated in the introduction to Psychotic Reactions and Carburetor Dung, the anthology of his work that was edited by Greil Marcus. I did the reporting years later, and the autopsy report reveals Darvon in his bloodstream, which was an analgesic painkiller. And that was known for its propensity for overdose. It was a dangerous drug, and it's no longer prescribed. And Valium as well. You know, all of his life he'd been an addict to various pills. Romalar, cough medicine, was a favorite. Dextromethorphan, the key ingredient in Romalar, which is no longer manufactured, is still in every cough medicine on the shelves today. It's the key ingredient that makes you stop coughing. And kids would abuse this through the 70s and into the early 80s. If you drink it in enough quantity, you trip like a wildebeest, as much as PCP. It's got psychedelic propensity. And now they put a chemical in cough medicine that's designed only to make you vomit if you drink enough of it to trip. But of all the things, at a time when cocaine and, you know, heroin and all the drugs that rock stars typically abuse were flowing, you know, rampantly, Lester was addicted to, you know, cough medicine and you know, cheap pills and alcohol.
Let's talk a little bit more about Lester Bangs as a critic. How did his taste in music compare to what we think of as like the rock and roll canon?
I think Lester was very much a proto Gen Xer. He was much of his career was in firm opposition to the baby boom critics. He was a baby boomer himself, but the baby boom pantheon that was being erected. You know, he did not hold that the Jefferson Airplane and all the San Francisco bands of 1967 were the high point of psychedelic rock or of rock and roll in the 60s. He preferred, you know, the grungy, what he called the Zit Farmers from San Jose, the Count Five, who recorded Psychotic Reactions and Carburetor Dung. And he lauded the Troggs, you know, the garage band from England, in the 30,000 word epic where he fantasized getting on a bus and driving to James Taylor and killing James Taylor in a brutal, violent assault, because he hated that sort of singer-songwriter music and celebrated this loud and aggressive proto-punk rock. He championed heavy metal and loved, called Black Sabbath the John Miltons of rock and roll. I can't emphasize enough that he had these great philosophical insights and intellectual, heavy intellectual ideas. Even when it was this, you know, rapid spew of colorful prose, there was real substantive ideas in there about the music he loved.
Now, although he loved music so passionately and felt so strongly about the musicians whose music he loved, he often got into these very combative relationships with musicians. And I think started to think of a lot of rock stars as being incredibly spoiled and obnoxious. You actually asked him, I think, about his interviewing style, about the combative style. Would you introduce this excerpt of the interview for us?
Exactly that. I mean, he was famous for his combative interviews with Lou Reed and for other rock stars, where he just refused to admit that they were the geniuses they were trying to portray themselves as, and would try to get at the real human being behind this image. And I asked him just that. How did you develop your interview style?
Well, basically, I just tried to start out to lead with the most insulting question I could possibly think of, you know, because it seemed to me that the whole thing of, like, interviewing, as far as, you know, rock stars and that, was just such a suck-up job, you know? I mean, it was, like, grovelingly, you know, just groveling obeisance to people that weren't that special, really, you know? It's just a guy. It's just another person. Right. So what?
That was Lester Bangs, recorded in a 1982 interview with my guest Jim DeRogatis, the author of a new biography of Bangs. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is rock critic Jim DeRogatis, author of Let It Blurt, a biography of the late rock critic Lester Bangs. Do you know what led Lester Bangs to want to start writing about rock?
I asked him that. I asked him exactly that, and this is what he said.
When I look back on it, it was obvious that I was going to end up doing this because, the two big obsessions are always music and writing, It's like, it's an outgrowth of being a fanatical record collector or a fanatical listener. Then you have fanatical opinions that you want to inflict on people.
I think that soundbite gets to how extreme he felt about things and how deeply things registered on Lester Bangs. How did he start to write for Rolling Stone magazine?
In 1967-68, Rolling Stone was desperate for anybody who would send anything in over the transom. And I talked to almost all the early editors at the magazine, and Lester was sending this stuff in, these long screeds, saying, look, you jerks, this is better than anything you're publishing, and you better run this or give me a reason why. And they were ignoring him because he was a shoe salesman who was tripping on Romolar, living in El Cajon, and they were, of course, in San Francisco, the center of the cultural universe in the Summer of Love. Finally, they ran a cover story on the MC5, and it was this fawning, glowing profile about how not only was the MC5 in Detroit a great rock and roll band, but they were going to be the leaders of the new revolution. And the White Panther Party, their manager, John Sinclair, was the leader of the White Panther Party. They were going to result in rioting in the streets and the New World Order and so on and so forth. And Lester rushed out and bought the album and thought that it was the biggest hype he had ever been sold. So he wrote this venomous response, record review in response, and it was so good that Rolling Stone finally published it. And he would, from that point on, he was sending four or five reviews a week, one or two of which might get published. And he was a big presence in Rolling Stone through its early golden days. When Greil Marcus became its first record review editor, he thought Lester was extraordinary, published him regularly. Those golden days only lasted, mind you, about a year. And Lester never really found his home at Rolling Stone. That was not where he did his best work. That would come later when he moved to Detroit and Cream Magazine. And when he got there, he met the members of the MC5, became best friends with them, and reversed his opinion. He came to think that the MC5 were a great band, and it was a shame that this political agenda had been superimposed on them. He did that a lot. A lot of times with Patti Smith or with Rolling Stone's Exile on Main Street, he would reverse his opinion, which I actually think is a sign of intellectual security, that he was strong enough in his own opinions that he could say, I've changed, I've grown, my opinion has been developed, and I've gained new insights. I don't think enough critics do that today.
Lester Bangs was banned from Rolling Stone in 1973. What kind of trouble did he run into at the magazine?
He'd gotten in trouble several times. He had panned Buddy Miles, who was, this soul schlocky drummer. And Miles stormed into the offices of Rolling Stone at one point looking for Jan Wenner and was going to throw him out the window. And Wenner ran down the fire escape while the secretaries called the police, and Miles roughed up another editor. That was one strike against Lester. Another was that he panned Canned Heat in a very funny and sarcastic review, saying, why do we love this endless boogie? Let us count the ways. And Wenner apparently was close to the manager of Canned Heat and blew a gasket and said, this guy is just not respectful enough to musicians.
Lester Bangs wrote a lot for Cream magazine. What was Cream's importance in the development of rock criticism?
Cream was an exceedingly irreverent publication. That I compare it to what was happening in new journalism. They were breaking the rules of criticism and journalism. Not that there were any rules. I mean, the whole form was developing, and it was this playground that just led the writers and the artists run free. And there was some great writing. People like Nick Toshes and Richard Meltzer and Dave Marsh and Lester Bangs, they were kind of making up the rules as they went along, writing these long, passionate screeds that sometimes were directly about the music and sometimes had nothing to do with the music at all, but were trying to show that, the writing itself could be rock and roll, and that you know, that they could create art that in some cases was better art than the music they were allegedly supposed to be covering. Meltzer prided himself on reviewing some albums by never opening the shrink wrap and just writing about the cover, which on one level shows a certain disrespect to the album, but on another, there was a deeper, more fundamental respect to the reader. They were having fun with the words. They were trying to create something that was very exciting, and they never underestimated the smarts of their readers, which is in stark contrast to a sort of criticism that exists today where everything's a 100-word record review and two thumbs up and these smiley, happy blurbs.
The people who worked for Cream lived together and worked together in a small farmhouse, and from your book it sounds like that was a pretty claustrophobic experience without any privacy.
It really was like a commune. They made $30 a month for spending on incidentals, and the publisher, Barry Kramer, stocked the refrigerator with bratwurst and beer, and they lived and worked in the same space. And it was even less privacy than they knew. I did a Freedom of Information Act request, figuring that the FBI was probably aware of these crazy hippie publishers because they were monitoring, of course, the White Panthers very, very closely from the 68 riots and before. And the feds were literally camped out in the woods like they did with the Unabomber, and occasionally spying on these people doing this magazine through binoculars and listening to Black Sabbath blaring from the woods, which is pretty funny. It's hard to imagine anybody like camping out and worrying about the reviewers at Entertainment Weekly today.
What would you say Lester Bangs' legacy is now in rock criticism?
That's a tough one, Terry. I think that a lot of people imitate the first person style and the gush of prose. Not even a lot of people. Some people imitate that. I think very few people go for the real legacy, which was that fundamental respect of the reader, that willingness to challenge the reader and to try to share deep philosophical insights and serious intellectual ideas with the reader, and not just this shilling of product. You know, here's a hip new album, go buy it, and next week there's another one. I think that that's what's been lost in rock criticism today, that there are very few people writing with that honesty or that commitment, and certainly not that insight.
You're a rock critic yourself, and I'm wondering if you think that rock critics now are faced with a lot of pressures to be positive about the records they review, particularly when those records are on labels represented by heavy advertisers.
Oh, absolutely. I think that the thing to remember that in Bang's day, in Richard Meltzer and Nick Toshes, when these guys were writing in the mid-70s, that there was no career as a rock critic. These guys were making $15 for these incredible, poetic, 15,000-word record reviews. And it was something you did because you believed in it passionately. And now it is possible to have a career as a rock critic and do very well in the same way that a lot of celebrity-oriented profilers write these obsequious, you know, fawning profiles of Hollywood stars. That's the sort of journalism that's infected the rock world. And the people who are writing, you know, because they feel compelled to do so in the same way that Bangs did, are pretty much marginalized. They're on the web, they're doing fanzines, or, you know, if they're lucky, they're able to write for newspapers or editors that give them the freedom to do that. But I think that they're the exception rather than the rule.
You end your biography of Lester Bangs with one of his pieces, a very funny and perceptive piece called How to Be a Rock Critic. Let me ask you to end our interview with a short reading from this piece.
Absolutely. I wanted people to go out on a laugh and not be depressed, because I don't think Bangs' story is a depressing one. Lately, I've noticed a new wrinkle on the American landscape. It seems as if there's a whole generation of kids, each one younger than the last, all of whom live, breathe, and dream of but one desire. I want to be a rock critic when I grow up. If that sounds condescending, let it be known that I was once just like them. The only difference was that when I held such aspirations, the field was relatively uncluttered. It was practically nothing to barge right in and commence the slaughter. Whereas now, of course, it's so glutted that the last thing anybody should ever consider doing is entering this racket. in the first place, it doesn't pay much and doesn't lead anywhere in particular. So no matter how successful you are at it, you'll eventually have to decide what you're going to do with your life anyway. In the second place, it's basically just a racket in the first place and not a particularly glorious one at that.
And he goes on to say, with language I can't really use, that it almost certainly won't get you any sex.
Yeah, absolutely. Although I think he was the exception. He was a rock critic who had groupies, probably the last one.
Jim DeRogatis, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your biography of Lester Bangs.
It was my pleasure, Terry.
Jim DeRogatis' biography of rock critic Lester Bangs is called Let It Blurt. DeRogatis is pop music critic at the Chicago Sun-Times. Coming up, Lloyd Schwartz on a new production of Macbeth, starring Kelsey Grammer. This is Fresh Air. TV star Kelsey Grammer is about to open on Broadway in the title role of a new production of Macbeth. Critic Lloyd Schwartz thinks that too few leading American actors get to play classic roles. But while he admires Grammer's daring, he questions the results.
When I was in graduate school, I had a small part in a production of Shakespeare's Measure for Measure, in which Isabella, the young novice who refuses to give up her virginity to save her brother's life, was played by Stockard Channing, who was still an undergraduate. I stood backstage watching her every night. I thought it was one of the greatest Shakespeare performances I'd ever seen. I still think so. It was so convincing, so painfully real, so complex and touching. I can still call up details of her performance and live through it again and again. I wish I could see her as Cleopatra, or Lady Macbeth. Marlon Brando has that same power as Mark Antony in the MGM film of Julius Caesar. He's more alive than even such British stalwarts as John Gielgud and James Mason. What I'd give to see Brando as Hamlet or King Lear. The best American actors can bring to a classic role a fresh burst of energy. Yet audiences, or at least producers, don't seem very interested in having stars do classic theater. How can they grow as performers if they can't play the greatest roles in a variety of styles? I've been thinking about this because Kelsey Grammer, TV's Frasier Crane, is doing something very risky right now. He's about to open on Broadway in a production of Macbeth. I saw the tryout in Boston, and although I dislike the production, I think it's very badly directed by Terry Hands, the former artistic director of the Royal Shakespeare Company. Too loud, too rushed, artsy yet unpoetic. I admire Grammer's courage. I think he could make a good Macbeth. He understudied the role 20 years ago and got to go on a number of times, and he's played several Shakespeare roles since then. He's intelligent, he has a resonant voice that projects well, and he has some real presence. What he doesn't have yet in this production is a character with an inner life. When he hears the three witches prophesy that he will become king, he completely fails to convey the way Macbeth is torn between his ambition and his sense of what's right, or between his ambition and his fear. At least he's not playing Macbeth as Frasier Crane. Yet on TV, he has more emotional variety. As Macbeth, he reads too many of his soliloquies as if they were saying only one thing, rather than depicting a character arguing with himself or thinking out his problems. Finally, though, in the later scenes of Macbeth's icy despair and moral emptiness, Grammer is more believable. In the famous tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow speech, he actually seems to be thinking about what he's saying. Unfortunately, he's mostly surrounded by boring actors, or actors who are even more poorly directed than he is. I think he's probably been away from Shakespeare too long. There hasn't been enough continuity or development of his talent. I can only imagine how much better he'd have been if he'd kept playing truly rich parts over the last 20 years. If he does well in New York, it will be interesting to see how soon he tries another classic role. And if he doesn't do well, it will be even more interesting to see how serious he really is about acting.
Lloyd Schwartz teaches English at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. A new Broadway production of Macbeth, starring Kelsey Grammer, is scheduled to begin previews June 9th. We'll close today's show with a recording featuring singer and saxophone player Tex Beneke. He died yesterday at the age of 86. Beneke was best known for his work with the Glenn Miller Band. He sang on such recordings as Chattanooga Choo Choo, Don't Sit Under the Apple Tree, and I Got a Gal in Kalamazoo. I'm Terry Gross.
Hi there, Tex, how's your new romance? The one you met at the campus dance.
Wait until you see her, you'll agree. My hometown gal's the only one for me. A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I got a gal.
In Kalamazoo.
Boast, but I know she's the toast
of Kalamazoo, zoo, 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 zoo.
Years have gone by.
My, my, how she grew.
I liked her looks when I carried her books
in Kalamazoo, zoo, 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 zoo.
I'm gonna send a wire, hopping on a flyer,
leaving today.
Am I dreaming? I can hear her screaming.
Hiya, Mr. Jackson. Everything's okay. A-L-A-M-A-C-O. Oh, what a gal. A real pimperoo.
I'll make my bid for that freckle-faced kid I'm hurrying to.
I'm going to Michigan to see the sweetest gal
in Kalamazoo.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. And from Random House Incorporated Bantam Books Division, publisher of Flags of Our Fathers by James Bradley with Ron Powers, a story of the men who raised the flag on Iwo Jima. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, David Sedaris returns to read from his new book. Sedaris is a best-selling author and a regular contributor to public radio's This American Life. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.